Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. Going back to our 25 years podcast and this series that we're taking a loving look back at the Ravens' history, joined today by a special guest, Joey Platania. How you doing, Joe?
Ken, thanks so much for having me. Great to be with you.
It's fantastic. We met at camp several years ago. I appreciate you making time for me. And Joe's one of the few guys who's been around long enough to talk about today's topic, which is one of the most important in this entire series, is how did the Ravens actually get a football team? How did Baltimore actually get a football team back after losing the Colts? So, Joey, you were around more at the time. Maybe I'll let you set this up in terms of where they were in the late 80s, maybe the Bidwell mistake and all that. Try and set us up through some of this.
Yeah, well, everybody remembers March of 84. That was at that point the Mayflower vans moved out on that snowy morning, and I couldn't even eat my cereal that morning as I looked out onto my backyard. I could still vividly recall the pain in my gut and the pain every Baltimorean felt in his or her gut that day. But just as Cleveland only had to wait 3 years and get an expansion team of their own, it was about 4 years after that, in the spring and summer of 1988, when it appeared the first glimpse of hope for Baltimore fans was coming, that a football team was coming, because the Bidwell family had owned the Cardinals for a long time, which, by the way, the oldest continuously operating sports franchise in North America. It started in 1894, but we won't go through all that. They were in Chicago, moved to St. Louis in 1960. And in 1988, they were getting dissatisfied there. They wanted a new stadium. They wanted a fresh start. And in 1988, it came down to Phoenix and Baltimore, and they chose Phoenix. And I'll never forget the column that Ken Rosenthal wrote in the Baltimore Sun when that decision came down. The lead sentence was, "The weather angle, it killed us." That's basically why they chose Phoenix over Baltimore. I don't need to tell anybody about the climate in both of those cities. So they went out there, and once again, Baltimore wanting an expansion team. I think a lot of people would have been rather ambivalent if the Cardinals had come here, just as they did when the Browns did, because what Baltimore didn't want to do is to do to another team what Indianapolis did to this town. They didn't want to have a set of broken, heartbroken fans crying and moaning about their team leaving. Baltimore wanted to do it the right way. The inherent decency of the fans here is something I'll never forget. So a few years later, the stadium offer, which I'm sure we'll get into in a bit later, was on the table. It was very attractive, a lot of owners to want to come here. I believe the Tampa Bay Buccaneers ownership was about ready to pull the trigger on the move. Art Modell simply beat them to the punch after warning everybody in Cleveland. Yes?
Okay. I just going to say, we have another step in here that we're kind of missing chronologically, is there's an expansion effort. So yes, I agree. And the expansion effort is key in understanding what you're just talking about, I think, because my own personal theory is the Ravens lost out on expansion when Charlotte and Jacksonville got their teams,
right,
in part because the other NFL owners wanted that offer still on the table so they could leverage their own towns for new stadiums all over the country. And they said,
no question,
if we give that away, then there's nothing on the table that's done that. And even other teams like the Glazers and other when they're in Tampa, I guess at this point, we're talking about, the Glazers were not yet in Tampa. They bought Tampa later, didn't they?
I think it was a bit later. Maybe Hugh Culverhouse was still in charge there.
Okay.
Because the fan base down there was very unhappy with him for several moves that he made, most notably alienating Bo Jackson into spurning Tampa Bay. But there was a lot of things they didn't like about him.
So in the early 90s, I don't know who was it Maryland Stadium Authority that then put out a attempt to sell club seats both at the old stadium, but more importantly at the new planned stadium?
Yeah. They were getting on the bandwagon of club seats and PSLs, which were a new thing at the time. I vividly remember the Baltimore media being invited to Memorial Stadium in one of their kind of rooms in the bowels of the stadium where some of the people from the Carolina Panthers came up to teach the Baltimore media how PSLs worked. I'll never forget that because it was a room in the stadium that I never knew existed. So, and I'd been there many, many times. So, but yeah, the people from the Panthers had to come up here and teach the Baltimore media how all that worked, how people paid for them, what they had the rights to, and all that stuff. And it was different, that's for sure. It was something the fans here definitely were not used to.
Right. Very, very different, by the way, in the NFL to own a PSL as opposed to in baseball. In baseball, when the Orioles built their new stadium, they had a completely anti-scalping view. They didn't want it around their stadium.
Right.
You know, they didn't want people selling their tickets, you know, and they even put it in the Orioles season ticket contract. In the NFL, it's just a very accepted part of having tickets is you have an opportunity sometimes to get more on the secondary market. And, you know, the attractiveness of that is even something that they're thinking about. So part of what happens with that is when you have a lot of PSLs for sale, people may come up and try and buy them in droves when a franchise is starting out. In Baltimore, their last experience with the Colts had not been good. Of course, with the Colts, generally speaking, they've been sold out for many years. But when they were about to leave town, they were at 15,000 a game, 18,000 a game. They weren't drawing, of course. And it would have been harder to understand that Baltimore was really going to fall in love with football again the way they did.
Yeah, it was a very special culture, a very special time when the Baltimore Colts were in their infancy and on through the 60s and 70s. And by the time the late 70s or early 80s came around, well, times change. And unfortunately, people change, the business climate change, and you have different kind of people getting into the business. Ergo, Robert Irsay, as different than anybody had ever seen before, certainly around here. And the climate certainly changed, and you're dealing with a different sort of personality, and that's being very charitable, of course.
Yeah. I mean, the Colts owners had something about them. Mikhail Rosenblum was one of the guys to raise his hands to go to the AFC, which was very unusual. He's the first one to put his hand up because they were paying $3 million.
Yeah, that helped.
He wanted that money.
And Art Modell and Art Rooney, they always did things hand in glove because they were such good friends, even though their teams were rivals. So that's why Baltimore, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh were the three teams to move.
Mm-hmm. And then they got Paul Brown, who had been an old NFL stalwart for a number of years, to come and be the fourth team with the Bengals.
The Bengals were an AFL expansion team, and then when the merger happened, they just simply climbed on board.
All right, so that expansion effort went. I'll tell you my experience with this. I put in money on the expansion effort in 1992, is my recollection in terms of the year. And there were some things happening that we had that silly preseason game between the Dolphins and Saints.
The Give Baltimore the Ball night.
That's it. That is exactly the thing, wasn't it?
Give Baltimore.
What else do you remember about that?
Give Baltimore the ball. It was all over TV. They made, I don't know, they may have made T-shirts, sweatshirts. I have no idea. But the reason why I remember it was 92. That game matched up the Miami Dolphins and the New Orleans Saints. And, of course, Miami was the draw because Don Shula used to coach here, even though he's remembered as a Dolphins coach. But that was the year that one of the most devastating hurricanes in Atlantic hurricane history happened, Hurricane Andrew. And it was such a long-lasting hurricane, the two cities that it devastated were Miami and New Orleans. So that tied in to Give Baltimore the Ball night, because some of those proceeds went towards hurricane relief in both cities. So you talk about serendipity, taking a terrible incident and using that those exhibition monies to help a couple of really battered communities at that time.
So definitely good in any kind of theory. And unfortunately, it didn't do much for Baltimore's football hopes at that point, because as the expansion situation progressed, a lot of people thought St. Louis would get one of the teams, and that, you know, Jacksonville and Charlotte had a very strong offer on the table in terms of what they were giving. But a lot of people thought football might return to St. Louis just because it's a big population center that didn't have a team anywhere closer, I guess, in Kansas City, right?
Yeah, Kansas City would probably be it. And Chicago's a bit north of there, but, you know, that's a heck of a big market, too. But in hindsight, when you bring up the fact that St. Louis was favored to get one of the teams, it seemed to be, again, in hindsight, a bit of backward thinking, on the part of the fan bases and the media observers covering that at the time, because what the league was trying to do was expand into new areas, get new markets. Personally, I mean, maybe that's just my bias coming through. I thought Baltimore would be one of the favorites, along with Jacksonville and or Charlotte. I know only two spots were available, but Charlotte seemed to be the fait accompli among the owners. and it was approved very quickly to be, at the time, the 29th franchise. So the 30th franchise was going to be between Baltimore and Jacksonville and St. Louis. I believe St. Louis was eliminated in the first round of voting, and then it came down to Baltimore and Jacksonville. Baltimore, currently, I think, the 25th largest TV market. Jacksonville's around 55th, which is why it was the fact that Jacksonville won out. It was a bigger upset than Super Bowl III. But Jacksonville did win out. They beat out of town with a much more rich football history and 30 notches higher in the TV market rankings. And all of a sudden, Baltimore was left on the outside looking in again. And again, like I said, Baltimore wanted to do it the right way. Get an expansion team and don't break another city's heart. But that was a great chance that they had right there. And it at the time, it didn't happen. And it looked like it would never happen.
Yeah, it was kind of a two-part process, because the first, you mentioned it in passing, I want to make sure people go back to this, is that Carolina was given the 29th franchise, and then they waited several months to give out number 30. And so I think part of the thought process there was that they were going to string these teams along, but also part of it was levering stadium commitments for money and whatnot locally all across the NFL. And that Baltimore's, you know, offer to build a publicly financed stadium was an incredibly powerful asset to the NFL to hold, during that process. Also, as it's discussed to me, as it's been discussed with me over the years, there was a lot of flirting going on with the NFL owners during the expansion process. Al Davis is one of that. Boy, that would have completely sucked to get the Raiders. That's all I can suck, because they had no loyalty to Baltimore at all. But they
slept around on everybody. I swear.
Yeah, they did. They've slept around on every town they've been. They change locations as often as a hooker changes underwear is one of the comments I always like to hear. But anyway, they are very, very much a prostitute, and they're in their fourth city now, always trying to sell themselves as a general franchise. That's not what Baltimore wants. Baltimore wants a local franchise.
No, this is not a transient town by any means. This is blue collar, salt of the earth, grassroots. If you're, this is like the Olive Garden of America. If you're here, you're family.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, maybe because I'm Italian, I would pull on that reference, but just the same. I mean, we're made of a different sort of stock here. We have a different kind of mindset here. It's not transient. It's not fly by night. It's not trendy. If you're gonna put down roots here, you better make the commitment. Okay, here we go with the hooker analogy again. Horrible to say, but if you're gonna make the commitment here, you better be true to us. Yeah, that's basically how I can more tactfully say it in cleaning all this up.
Yeah, it certainly is a process. So now we've come to the end of the expansion effort. There's no more expansion teams to be given this round. You know, and of course, there's always another expansion round that'll come someday later. And the Texans, in fact, got a team. Who am I missing? So the Texans,
the Cleveland Browns were an expansion.
Oh, right. There you go. The Cleveland Browns and the Texans. Yes. So there were additional rounds of expansion, and presumably Baltimore maybe would have had another chance there. I don't really believe it. I believe that as long as the publicly financed stadium was on the table, and as long as the Maryland had significant detractors, and it's interesting because on baseball and football, this is so diametrically opposed, but Jack Kent Cook did not want a team in Baltimore for very obvious reasons. He didn't want competition with the Redskins. Paul Tagliabue was a very outspoken. I mean, he said some things that were beyond stupid for an NFL commissioner to say. He says maybe they're football towns, they're museum towns. Maybe Baltimore's a museum town.
Yeah, a Georgetown University graduate. He played basketball there. Not for John Thompson, I don't think. He came along a little bit before that. But Tagliabue, native New Yorker, D.C., Georgetown law graduate, which is how he became the counsel to the NFL in the Roselle years. And he didn't like it. And another fellow who was opposed to this, we went over this before we hit the button, was a current Maryland senator named Chris Van Hollen, who was in the House of Delegates at the time representing Montgomery County. Now, to me, Montgomery and PG counties, you might as well call them annexed territories of the District of Columbia. And they don't like Baltimore. They're always looking down their nose on Baltimore with a superiority complex that I don't think they've earned or deserve to have. See, everyone talks about an inferiority complex in Baltimore. I've lived here all my life. I think it's a myth. I just think it's a superiority complex from south of us that they haven't earned or deserved. Baltimore's a better sports town. I don't care what anybody says. But yet the folks down south, 40 miles to our south, including most notably Chris Van Hollen and Paul Tagliabue. Chris Van Hollen voted against the stadium package. I definitely remember that because it just smacked to me of typical DC-ism. I know that's not a word, but that's certainly what it looked like at the time, because DC was definitely going to put the roadblock in our way.
Yeah. If you think about this and compare and contrast to what happened with baseball, of course, the Expos had to go somewhere. They had to move them out of Montreal and they had to move somewhere, or they had to contract the league, which it's not like that's never happened. There's certainly been teams that have been folded up. And, you know, during our lifetimes, Joe, that we saw the WFL come and go, for example.
Right.
That would have been an example of that. But the other things, the USFL and other teams fold up, leagues fold up. But it's rare that you have a really successful league like Major League Baseball that contracts teams. But it did happen, or it was thought to be happening, that Minnesota and Montreal could have gone away. And instead, they moved Montreal to Washington. They really took away half or more of Baltimore's market. And it was a lot of the additional money in the market was down closer to D.C. But those people had been good Oriole fans. They'd come to games. And it was really a shame that happened. And then there's a loss of focus on the TV rights that went with that, because that was supposed to be the wear guild, the reparations payment, if you will, to Baltimore for losing a huge portion of their market. And then the Nationals are saying, we can't keep paying that. And yes, you can, or you can move. I mean, those are really the options available, because this is our market and you stole a large portion of it.
Yeah, it's called a contract, you know.
Yeah,
it's called a contract, and I guess DCP. People living with corruption as they do, they don't seem to want to honor the contract. And the fact that a couple of court decisions have gone Washington's way on this is stunning to me. It really is.
Yeah. Anyway, the diametrically opposed nature. Don't ever think that Baltimore and Washington are in the same boat. Basically, no. I don't think it's true for football, but for baseball, they are locked in a death struggle, and there will only be one franchise here come 30 years from now. I've been saying that for a while, and using 30 years for a while, so it might not actually happen within another 15.
I will say this though: Washington may have the larger market and fan base. Baltimore has the better stadium. So which one wins out in that battle? That's very intriguing to me.
Yeah. It's really hard to do as badly as they did in Washington in terms of building a new stadium with all of the great stadiums out there. I mean, Camden Yards stands out among the 1990s stadiums, but how could you do it so poorly?
Yeah.
Relative to that, and that
new Comiskey in Chicago, which opened a year before Oriole Park, and which I thought was going to, you know, steal Oriole Park's thunder. Oh, my God. They really laid an egg on that one.
They tanked it. Yeah. Yeah, they did. All right. So let's talk a little bit. We get a little closer now to the time. So there's a lot of talk going around. Other teams are trying to lever Baltimore's publicly financed stadium into something for themselves, threatening to leave their cities willy-nilly across the NFL, always coming back to, well, I don't think it's any secret that Baltimore has a publicly financed, you know. So you heard the language at that time. And then in the middle of the night, give us kind of what you know about that, Joy, what you can detail.
Oh, about the closing the deal with Cleveland?
Yeah.
Well, I will say this. Like I mentioned earlier, Tampa Bay could have beat him to the punch, but Art Modell had tried to let his feelings be known, a fixture in the Cleveland community. I mean, for that alone, he should have been in the Hall of Fame, but that's another subject for another day. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he had tried to warn the Cleveland community, help me out here or I'm going to leave. And I'll just never forget at that last Browns home game before they moved, everybody had signs up that said that Art lied. Lied about what? This was not the same as the Irsay situation, although some people say it is. Art Modell was very sober, very cogent, and he made his intentions clear to everyone. You know, the Indians got, at the time, Jacobs Field. The Cavaliers got Gundarena, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I think there was a science museum, a science center built there, too. I'm not really sure about that. But the other three used up enough money. And Art made it clear to Mayor Michael White at the time and the Cleveland city fathers and the business community, look, everybody's getting theirs. I filled up this death trap of a stadium for years and years and years. People on the Ravens PR staff, Kevin Byrne, Francine Lubera, would talk about the leaks in the press box, the leaks coming from the roof above and walking through puddles in the concourses and all that sort of thing. They had firsthand knowledge of that sort of thing. So Art laid everything out on the table and said, look, if you don't help me out here, something's going to happen. And then in the middle of the 95 season, which was a very promising one for the Browns on the field, it looked as though they had built a team that could compete to go to a Super Bowl and win a Super Bowl. Ozzie Newsome is on record as saying they would have won a Super Bowl if they'd have stayed in Cleveland with those players. But of course, the announcement of the move on the first week of November, November 4th, the Friday night when Mark Viviano broke it on Channel 11, November 6th, when it became known, and right before a Cleveland home game, no less. And that's when the season came out from under the Cleveland Browns. And that's when a lot of a tempest in a teapot of raw emotion took place in Cleveland.
All right. So it was 1995, and they were there in time for 1996. For some reason, I have a recollection that was most of the 1995 season. Maybe that's still true of November 1st or whatever, that the Browns were playing under this dark cloud and you know, with a fan base that's just incredibly pissed off about what's happened.
Yeah. The announcement of the move, like I said, the first week in November. Before then, the Browns had gotten off to a great start. It looked like they were going to be they were a playoff team in 94. Mm-hmm. And I believe Bill Belichick was their head coach, as a matter of fact. But they lost in the second round of the playoffs to New England. Irony Bell there. And then 95 came around. They put another good team on the field. And then news of the move came down. And the air went out of the balloon in Cleveland, just as it did here in Baltimore in March of 84. And which is why some Baltimore fans were rather ambivalent towards the team coming here, because we looked at what happened in Cleveland and we were like, hey, that was us. That was us crying in our beer so long ago. So, you know, but at the same time, I was saying, speaking just for me, I was saying to myself, look, we've been out of the league for 11 or 12 years. Cleveland got promised an expansion team within 3 years, a new stadium. They keep the logo. They keep the records. Baltimore didn't get all that nationwide sympathy. As far as I'm concerned, we're a better football town than Cleveland. I mean, right. You just look at the history. I mean, yeah. The Cleveland people would, you know, be throwing pierogies at me if they heard that. I don't care. I think I'm right. But another city's heart was broken. That's what Baltimore didn't want. But to get back into the league where we rightfully belonged had to happen.
Yeah, I mean, they tried every legitimate avenue first. They tried expansion. They were whored around like everybody's business in every other NFL city to get what they wanted. I mean, eventually it just happens. You have to play dirty to win every once in a while. Yeah. And you know, there wasn't another way. There wasn't another expansion on the site. And, you know, even if there had been, the funding might not have stayed around. You know, this is a city that might not have kept the funding available. So, you know, particularly if, you know, you want the NFL to do something, you want them to award you a franchise. One of the things you need to just do is make the financing temporary. You know, you should do that because, you know, obviously you want to have the ability to extend it, but you also want to have the ability to force them to make a decision now.
I believe the funding was temporary in the mid 90s because I remember an anecdote where the deadline for the funding to remain on the table was about to run out. And a lot of Colts, old Colts Corral supporters, everybody went down to Annapolis to try to urge the legislature, keep the funding on the table. And the Colt band showed up. Played the Baltimore Colt fight song walking up the street towards the State House. It was a moment that made a lot of grown men cry that day because after that happened, after that impromptu rally in Annapolis, the funding was reapproved. It stayed on the table just in time for Art Modell to take advantage of it.
Yeah. You know, a great story. Obviously, the way the Ravens came here and the immediate success has really pissed off a lot of people. One of the people who I'll give you a little bit of my background here. Went to Syracuse, and I knew I was not good enough to be a sportscaster when I graduated, but had an opportunity to interview as Bob Costas' as assistant. Okay, that was in 1986. And then in 1996, 10 years later, Bob Costas on the sideline at the very first game talking about how Baltimore should have never got a franchise. Lost all respect for the guy.
Well, I don't blame you for that because he's always struck me as the kind of guy who's going to line himself up with the popular point of view. He is going to be a follower, not a leader. a conformist of the highest sort. And the reason why I think I'm observant enough to point that out is because I've never been a conformist. Anybody who knows me, 42 years in Baltimore sports media over parts of six decades, anybody who's ever met me knows I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not going to kowtow to what the popular opinion is. That's what Bob Costas has always done. For all his technical quality, high quality as a play-by-play guy, the aura he puts around himself to act that way, I've just never been on board with that.
Well, anyway, I don't disagree with some of those comments about Bob. It's really a shame because, you know, it was he could have gotten on board. But I guess he might have been from Ohio as well.
I thought he grew up in St. Louis. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. You very well might be right.
He was a broadcaster for the St. Louis Spirit of St. Louis of the ABA.
Okay.
And he went to Syracuse, of course, as did many broadcasters. Mm-hmm. As for where he's from originally, I mean, his resume is transient enough, so transient, well, I don't know where the guy's from. Mm-hmm. And I'm not ashamed to say that. It's amazing with him. And he's a legend in the business. I understand that. But I swear to God, the way he just aligns himself a certain way, attitude-wise, it's just shocking, even all these years later. He was here for that first game, September 1st, 1996. Picture postcard weather that day, which mm-hmm. I will never forget. I think it was Tom Hammond and Bob Trumpy in the booth. And Bob Trumpy, who used to play in Cincinnati,
he had a bunch of stupid things, too.
He had a few things to say, and there were signs in the stands that Trumpy sucks or whatever they were. But, yeah, Tom Hammond and Bob Trumpy were in the booth for that first game with the Ravens and the Raiders. And I'll tell you, this may have nothing to do with expansion, but one thing I will never forget about that day is that as you know, the locker rooms, you had to access the locker rooms by the baseball dugouts in mm-hmm. Memorial Stadium. And about an hour or so before the game, out of one of the dugouts comes Al Davis, managing general partner of the Raiders. The minute he set foot on the playing surface, the PA system began playing Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones. And I thought to myself, what just happened? But see, here's the thing. It wasn't really meant to be aimed at Al Davis. That was part of the regular pregame tape the Ravens had planned for every game. But the way they played it that day, I will never forget that.
That's perfect. That is absolutely perfect. Well, Jerry, really appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us about this. A great reminiscing about this. It's a murky period for me even, and it's great to hear a lot of more the details that I'd forgotten from you and go through this again. But a lot of people, you know, younger than us, and that's pretty much everybody, you know, is going to not recall this era, I think, as well. And it's worth trying to preserve, I think. So, Joey, thanks for coming on. Where can people talk football with you?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been with the sports column website, thesportscol.com. We do a podcast there. We tape it every Thursday. It's up every Thursday night. We've had 9 episodes in the book. It's called Joey P. and Frank. I'm still doing a lot of writing, game stories, the most complete Ravens opponent preview you'll find everywhere. That runs every Tuesday. And my straight up predictions for every game on the NFL schedule every week. I'm hitting about 70% winners right now, which is par for the course for me. Definitely want to get better, but we're still doing that. And extra games to pick this year with the 17th week. Didn't think we'd see that, but I guess the cash cow is going to keep bringing in money, so they're going to keep adding games. But a lot of good stuff on the sportscol.com. We link to everything on my Facebook page and on Twitter at Baltimore Joey P.
All right. And folks, if you're hearing this and you want to do a 25 years podcast, any reminiscence about Ravens history is good. We're not looking for Mount Rushmore, top tens, you know, those kind of things. What we are looking for is individual players looking back, individual events, individual games, trends. You know, if you feel passionate about the way the Ravens have used dimebacks over the years, that's the kind of great topic I love. Anyway, Joey, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so very much, Ken. This has been an absolute blast.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.